When the world is calling, whether it's sunny beaches, global cities, or boardrooms that can't wait, getting there starts here. With over 55 nonstop destinations, a new nonstop to Montreal on Air Canada, and 20 nonstop flights a day to New York City, Columbus makes travel simpler, smarter, and closer than you think. Start your trip at flycolumbus.com.
A serial killer sends investigators a series of notes detailing his crimes. In them, he mentions a married woman who drove a white Grand Am. He claims he murdered her and that investigators should be able to use his clues to identify her. There's one problem, though. Investigators can't find any missing person or murder cases that match these clues. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane. At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Tanya Todd.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, we were just saying before we started recording that, like, every episode is hard. Like,
there are no fun episodes.
No.
No.
This one, though, was particularly hard for me to put together. Like, I definitely entered into, like, malaise after this.
Okay. Should I be worried?
I mean, always. But, like, this involves a serial killer. It's just so many dead women, to be honest. And so I think, like, when I encounter that, just, like, person after person, it's just really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this one in particular deals a lot with, in this case, like, a very young woman. She's just 15, and it's devastating to me. And so I really want to tell as much as I can about her story. So today we're going to talk about Rocío Sperry, and she was born in Cuba in 1972 and went missing in Colorado in 1987. And to tell her story, though, or what we know of it, we actually have to tell the story of these other women, because Rocío's path intersects with this serial killer who some believe killed more women than the Green River Killer, if you remember our episode.
Oh, yeah, that was a pretty heavy episode.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of debate about whether or not what he's saying is true or not. This episode's a little bit different in that I include some of his words in here. So yeah, this is, to me, like, just devastating. So when most people try to tell Rocío's story, they actually start with a 13-year-old named Heather Dawn Church, and we're going to do the same.
Is she also one of the victims?
Yes.
Okay.
So now, in this life, Heather and Rocío never knew one another. Heather was 6 years younger than Rocío, and though they both lived and died in Colorado, the two led very vastly different lives. But like Rocío, Heather's life intersected with this serial killer, who I think is like one of the most truly evil men that I've read about. And while I don't want to take off the focus from Rocío, it really is about all the women this person harmed, and the men too.
Okay, so she's 6 years younger. Does she disappear first or
second?
Okay. Yeah. So he's really going after like young teens here.
Not exclusively, but these two very are similar in age, though different life circumstances.
Okay.
So I'm going to start talking about Heather a little bit. Heather was born in 1978.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is going to make this...
Okay, so these are kind of close to, like... I don't think we've ever had one that's the same age as me. Like, we've had ones, like, same age as my sister, who's 10 years older than me, or, like, a little bit younger.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always hard when it's, like, you know, when you can relate it to somebody, either in your family or yourself.
Well, like, I mean, I just start to imagine, you know... So Heather is actually a little bit older than I am. Mm-hmm. Or would have been. And like, I start thinking about like what I was doing at that age or what my life was like. And then also all of the things that I've done since.
Right. It's the done since part, right? Like, yeah, that's the hard part.
So Heather, she lived in Black Forest, Colorado with her parents and her siblings. And by 1991, her family was actually going through a difficult time. Her parents were divorcing, and all the accounts said that, you know, she seemed to be handling it well at the time. During the separation, Heather's father moved out, leaving the home to her mother and siblings. They lived on Eastonville Road, which is quite a long road that runs north to south through Colorado and is about 18 miles from Colorado Springs, where her dad worked. So it really made sense that he ended up being the one moving out to Colorado Springs just to be closer to his job. On September 17th, 1991, Heather's mom needed to take her two oldest sons to a Boy Scouts meeting, and she wanted to stay after that to take a class. And Heather, who's the oldest of the siblings, offered to watch her youngest brother, who was just 5 at the time. And so she stays at home with the youngest brother, and the two other brothers go to this Boy Scouts meeting with her mom. Now, even though Heather was 13, her mom was really diligent about checking up on the kids while she was out that evening. And so at around 8:30, she called Heather, who had let her brother stay up past their bedtime. And the two talked about that and, you know, how they'd been watching television together while the rest of the family was out. At roughly 10:15 p.m., Heather's mother and brothers return home, and the brothers go into their shared room, and they come back out and they say they can't find their younger brother. And so she's briefly panicked because the sliding door had been unlocked, and their mom goes in and she checks, but she finds him like basically tucked under his blankets. He hadn't been feeling well that evening, and so he just kind of created like a little blanket nest, basically.
This was a very late Boy Scout meeting, wasn't it?
Well, so it's a Boy Scout meeting, and then her mom was taking a class in the same building after.
Oh, so the kids had to wait.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then all the kids run in and say they can't find Heather. And Heather's mom says that basically she didn't get that initial rush of worry because of what just happened with the youngest brother. But when she goes and checks Heather's room, she's not there. So she starts searching the entire house, basically looking for her.
It's weird that they thought the little one was missing, and then it's yeah, Heather.
It's Heather. So her mom immediately calls 911, and as fairly typical with a lot of what we've seen, she's put off and told basically most of the calls like this are just kids who are going to parties and that she'd likely be back soon. But unlike a lot of the stories that we told her, like, mom just does not give up calling. She just keeps calling back because she knows something's wrong and that her daughter's, like, not.
Right. And also, I think, like, it's so crazy to me because 13 sounds so young to me still.
Yes.
Like, I have children that are older than 13, and I remember it back to how little 13 really is in actuality. Mm-hmm. But people tend to think that 13 is a teenager and, like, oh, they can do all the things that other teenagers can do.
Yeah.
That's not really the case in most. So, like, for some families, yes.
Yes.
13 means wildly independent, able to do a lot of things on their own. But for some families, 13 still means not much different than 11 or 12 meant.
Right.
So yeah, in this family, like, if Heather's mom knows that Heather's more on that end of, like, you know, still checking in with mom and dad, still being part of her brother's lives, like.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, like, her mom has literally been on the phone with her earlier that evening to check in, right?
Like, right.
Just 2 hours before, they'd had a conversation about bedtime, about, like, her staying up too late watching their favorite shows. So she's being dismissed this way. Like, she's not happy.
Right. And we've seen this so much with, like, everyone throughout, like, you can talk about something from, like, the 50s to now, and you're going to hear the same thing. Like, oh, she's a teenager, she ran off, but parents know if their kids are the kind that go to parties or not. They know if they're the kind that would run away or not. Like, let's let the parents make those.
Right. So her mom is just like, no. So yeah, they finally dispatch someone at 11:30 p.m., thankfully, right? So the calling nonstop. So this is pretty quick. Mm-hmm. Like, it's an hour and 15 minutes after. There's no clear signs of forced entry, which would have suggested an abduction, but thankfully the sheriff's deputy was concerned enough to call for a search and rescue, but the search can't begin until the next morning. So they're, like, waiting for daylight.
Mm-hmm.
During this wait, Heather's mom recalled a small detail, and that's the curtains in the master bedroom were, as she described, kind of messed up.
So, point of entry.
Yeah, so she's like, there's something there. Something's not right with the curtains, right?
Heather's mom is on it.
Yes. So the next morning, when more help arrived, Heather's mom mentioned this and that the window screen seemed off, like it wasn't in the right way.
Mm.
And so this leads to a quick appraisal of the window. And when dusted for fingerprints, there were 3 very clear prints on the edge of the screen. Now, they're going to run these prints later. And when they're run through databases at the Colorado Bureau of Investigations, there's no matches. But at this point, you know, it's seeming like something's happened.
Right. There were prints, though. There is somebody, whether they're in the system or not, right?
Right. Something's happened. So, but despite these and this massive search for Heather, she wasn't found. And so, you know, it's days turning into weeks, turning into months, and rumors start swirling, like maybe she did run away from home. And so people start saying that they'd reported sightings of her, you know, just about everywhere. So clearly some people at this point believe that she did run away.
As people will think.
Right.
It's so crazy because no one ever thinks that like the 18-year-old ran away.
Yeah, it's just, it's fascinating how disappearances are coded, right?
Yeah.
But things in this case dramatically change in 1993. So this is nearly 2 years after she's disappeared. A man named Timothy Belbeck was looking for scrap metal on Rampart Range Road, which is not far from Garden of the Gods. There, he went to investigate an abandoned vehicle in a ravine, and he spotted a human skull not far away. Now, it takes him 4 days to work up the courage to go actually report this to police.
Okay, so this is a scrap metal. This is our first scrap metal
discovery.
Yes. What's Garden of the Gods, though?
Oh, it's like this beautiful landscape feature in Colorado. It's stunning.
Okay.
Yeah. Like my parents went there, I think maybe close to their honeymoon. And they like always mentioned it when I was growing up.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. So you grew up hearing about it. This is my first time hearing about it. But it sounds like it would be pretty. But it also sounds to me, because I've never heard of it before and had nothing to put it into perspective, a very scary sounding place to find a human skull.
Right. So it's not. They didn't find it there, but just like close in proximity to it. And yeah, so next vacation road trip, you and your family should go to Garden of the Gods.
Yeah, I don't know. I just got back from a really rocky trip. So we'll see.
Yeah.
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 Maybe I'll start by going like somewhere a little closer.
You need some trip success behind you.
I need some positive experience with the actual travel part. The trip was great. The actual travel part.
Not so. Okay, so we have this scrap metal guy. He, though, does not report this right away. He is hesitant. Like, he's not the best.
Oh, is he like citizen? A little bit?
He's got some things going on. So he doesn't immediately want to, but he finally works up the courage to go talk to them. So
he did the right thing, even if he's like that kind of guy.
He's a little hesitant, but he goes into the Colorado Springs PD, and they are like, nope. They're sending him to El Paso County Sheriff's, and they say that the skull was not in their jurisdiction, so you need to go talk to El Paso. And so there, El Paso assumes that the body of the person was actually inside the car and deemed it an auto fatality and sent him to the Colorado State Police. And so I have to emphasize here that at any point, this man who has had to work up the courage to go in and talk to police could have just bailed and no one would know anything.
Really? So he says it was near the vehicle and they keep saying it was in the vehicle?
Yeah. So he says, I found a skull near a vehicle. And they're like, well, the body must be in the car. And that's an auto fatality. So that's not what we handle here.
So they think an auto fatality happened so long ago that it was actually a skull separated from the rest of the body that was still inside the car?
Yeah, so they're just not.
And nobody has ever discovered this wreck?
No. So it's in a ravine. So he's just like, yeah, they're like, no, we're off this.
Sounds like we're very tired. We don't want
nobody
to
wants,
commit to anything.
Nobody wants to do what they should. This reminds me of the episode we did where they're sending the family. Like, people are trying to report, like, an auto accident, and they're like, nope, not us.
Yeah.
Right. But, so the Colorado State Police finally send out a trooper who goes and collects the skull. And he brings it to the El Paso County Sheriff's, and they reject it. Mm. On the presumption that, again, this is an auto fatality.
Okay.
Yeah. So this trooper brings the skull to the El Paso County Coroner's Office, and the skull is logged in there, finally.
Did anyone actually ever look in the vehicle for the rest of the body?
No body in the vehicle.
So, and they're still just like, yeah, no, it's from the car accident.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So after getting done work, the trooper is going to go meet his daughter for dinner. Okay, so they're father-daughter.
And this is which trooper? This is the Colorado State?
Yep, the guy trooper.
Tried.
Yes. Okay, so there. He has left his file work which included some Polaroids of the skull on the seat of his vehicle. And so his daughter looks in and she sees these images of the skull. And she says, "Dad, it's Heather Dawn."
How would she know?
So there's like Heather Dawn missing persons flyers everywhere. So for the 2 years, these have been everywhere. And so she points to the flyer and says, "That's her." And she recognizes this skull because Heather has like a distinct tooth pattern in the front.
This is like, you know, when we're reading a book and you're like, this is too much of a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
This is like too much of a coincidence. They do happen.
They do happen, right? And so yeah. The trooper's daughter, Rhiannon Quintana, she was only 13 years old.
Oh my gosh.
The same age as Heather when she went missing. If she was alive, Heather would actually have been 15, so 2 years older.
So they were very much in the same age range.
Yeah.
And she recognized this girl by her teeth. That is craziness. The dad must have just been like, whoa, what? You know, like, you're happy something's happening, but at the same time, he was probably like, wow, I shouldn't have let my daughter see these
right
disturbing photos of somebody that she might know, like,
yeah,
or know of.
So this is huge, right?
Yikes. Yeah, that is huge. That is, like, probably the most interesting way that anyone's, like, in all of these discussions we've had, like, that anyone's ever, like, ID'd a body.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, thanks to a 13-year-old girl who saw those photos, saw those missing persons flyers, and knew what Heather Dawn looked like. Now, Heather's remains, finding them, this reinvigorates the case. The FBI steps in, they do a profile of the potential killer, there's more searches, but all of this fails to identify her killer. In 1995, Lou Smith took over this case. So Smith is actually an interesting person. I just want to give him his due here. Smith had worked high-profile cases before, including the murder of Kelsey Grammer's sister, Karen Grammer, who was brutally murdered in 1975 when she was just 18. He also famously left the JonBenet Ramsey case because he didn't agree with some of the directions it was taking. So he's worked on, like, some major cases. Now, with a newly assembled team, the fingerprints that were found at the scene were run through the automated fingerprint identification system. And a week later, on March 24th, they were called with a match.
So now they are matched?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the first time they didn't have a match and now they do.
Yep.
Good. Okay.
Okay. So they are matched with a neighbor of Heather's. He lived just a quarter mile away from her. Now, during this investigation into this man, those working the case came to believe that it was possible that he had actually kept Heather alive in his shed a few days before her murder.
Which I guess is possible, right?
Yeah. And he ends up pleading guilty to murdering her in a plea deal. And this is because it took death penalty off the table. So he would serve life in prison and was held in Colorado because that's where the murder took place and where he had been living.
Okay, so it's 1995, so this is 4 years after Heather was killed. I'm just trying to piece it all together because so it's her neighbor.
Yes.
So we're, like, I'm getting ahead of us here, but, like, are all of the murders that take place all kind of around this area too?
No.
They're not. Okay, so they're spread all over. So she's the one closest mm-hmm. to this house? Okay.
Yeah.
What made them think that she was alive for a few days? Did they ever say?
Just from some evidence that they found at the scene. I'll just leave that there.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is going to get, like, a lot worse. Okay. So, we're going to call this man R.
Okay.
And at the time of his arrest, he was in his early 40s. And I don't usually go into killers' bios too much, but there are so many unsolved cases in this that I'm going to add some in case that helps people think through where he was at different times. Because I want to emphasize that there are a lot.
Okay. So that neighbor guy is R and he is the killer.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's confessed.
So at this point, we're not looking for who the killer is. We're just kind of piecing together the rest of his victims.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So we know he killed Heather Dawn Church and he was put in prison for this murder. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of telling a little bit about him. He was born in 1952 in Coushatta, Louisiana, and he was the youngest of 9 children. His father was a sheriff's deputy. Now, R has a long history with women. So his first wife, Terry, was just 13 when they got married in 1970. If you're wondering, he was 17 at the time.
Okay. It's like, isn't that an acceptable age difference? 1970 in Louisiana?
I don't know. Well, I don't care their age difference. I don't think anyone should marry a 13-year-old.
I don't think so either.
Now, she would later say that he didn't hit her, but he was easily angered and punched things. She said he once jokingly held her over a hotel balcony.
Okay, so ladies, to clarify, if someone ever holds you over a hotel balcony, there's nothing jokingly about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a red flag.
Yeah. So
big one.
She says, and I think I come across this often, it's like, well, he didn't hit me, but he...
He punched something near me.
Yeah.
He dangled me.
Like, that is still abuse.
Yeah.
Okay, so 2 days after their marriage, mind you, she's just a 13-year-old girl, he leaves for Vietnam. And when he returned, he said he didn't love her anymore. And so the two divorced in 1973.
I think that's probably better for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His second wife was Toyet Minh Hun, and they were married in 1974. And the two had a son together. And R went back to Vietnam, and the two eventually divorced in 1976. In between there, he was in Germany, where he had an affair with a married woman. This woman moved to Colorado Springs, and when R left the military, he had custody of his son and went to Colorado Springs, where this woman helped care for this boy. But then R returns to his hometown and eventually gave his son to the boy's aunt to raise.
So, and this is his son with the Vietnamese woman?
Yes.
Okay.
His third wife, Brenda, was just 17 when they married in 1977. She would later tell investigators he had threatened to kill her, and when she did try to leave him, he kidnapped her and beat her. She told investigators she isn't sure how she survived the attack and called him the devil's right-hand man. Their divorce happened in 1980. So at this point, his marriages are lasting around 2 to 3 years.
So they're lasting around 2 to 3 years. Whether the woman understands it or not, they're all abusive.
Yes.
And he seems to really like teenagers.
Right. So then his fourth wife was Rita Morgan, and they married in 1980. And so she's a bit older. She's 26 at the time, though she had met him when she was 16, and he had begged her to write to him when he was deployed. But she did, and kind of got bored with it and stopped.
Okay.
So she reconnected with him later as an adult, and he first tried to strangle her 1 week after they got married. Rita ends up staying with him slightly longer, divorcing him in 1984. When he was arrested in Colorado in 1995, he was actually married to his fifth wife, Diane. They had bought the house on Eastonville Road, close to Heather's house, in 1990 so that R could start a tree farm. She filed for divorce the month after he was arrested for Heather's murder, but this wasn't finalized until 1996. So you can see he has this very long, strained history with women that's like riddled with abuse,
mm-hmm.
right? And so when they actually initially brought him in for questioning about Heather's murder, a good percentage of that initial interview was him talking about his horrible childhood, how he'd been abused and suffered at the hands of his siblings. So in a lot of ways, despite being an abuser, he himself has seen himself as an abused person.
Which is good for him, but he doesn't really need to keep that kind of abuse going. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's one thing, because I do know that, like, a lot of people who suffer abuse go on to become abusers. This guy seems like he's taking that very far, though. Like, it's not just, like, a thing of mismanaged feelings and, like, lack of therapy. This is...
Right. This is, like...
This is deep.
Something else. But he really has wanted to paint himself very much as, like, the world is against him, right? And so... Him being arrested, I feel like, even though he did commit the murder, I think is just another way of him being like, see, the world is against me. Right. He's like,
it's just like
that guy, right? Now, we can feel a lot of ways about what I'm going to say next, but he and his decision to kill Heather Dawn Church ends him up in prison, largely in isolation. He's in the SHU, or special housing unit, which is he's being held in solitary confinement. And that means he's in his cell without a cellmate, and he's let out for an hour a day. So otherwise, it's 23 hours in his cell out of 24. So he's in isolation, which I think is important, because I think he's just... at loose ends and doesn't know what to do with himself. But he, in 2000, so He's been in there for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
He decides to write a letter and he sends it to the district attorney's office where it's forwarded to one of the detectives who'd been on Heather's case. Now, R writes what we're going to call a riddle. And I hesitate to read this again because it gives space to his voice. But honestly, I think that the more minds who are on what he's trying to say, the better. Okay. So he writes in this letter, this is what it says. In the murky, placid depths, beneath the cool, caressing mire, lie seven golden opportunities. Missed opportunities?
So do we know what this means?
No. I mean, yes.
Now I do. But at the time, nobody knew what this meant?
No.
Is it like, is he trying to tell where the location of seven individuals are?
Right. Well, so the detective who
has like it. That would be my first guess. It's like seven girls are at this place.
Yes. So the detective he sends it to, Mark Finley, he writes back and is like, what is it you want?
Mm-hmm.
Right. He gets another letter in response and it's another riddly thing.
Why is this guy write only in riddles?
I mean, it reminds me of like those movies from that era where it was like the super smart serial killer leaving clues. Kind of like Seven, or I mean Seven came later, but like,
so he's trying to make himself feel super smart.
Yes.
Oh my god.
This next message says, foreign jurisdictions need not bother. This seven concerns no other. The seven sacred virgins entombed side by side, those less worthy are scattered wide. No advantage will be gained until your minds have been drained. Once they're drained, it becomes clear. Dig in deep for the ones so dear. If this enigma is to be solved, embrace the others who are involved. The high priestess, though not of importance, through practiced hysterical cries of ignorance. If you show no ambition to pursue this to fruition, you obviously are not the ones. This communion is forever done.
So, like, who does this guy think he is?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is like he clearly thinks he's very much smarter than anybody else.
He does. And this is also, like, honestly, like, movie villain territory.
Right. This seems fictitious, right? Like, yeah. It feels like you're telling me about some, like, made-up guy. Also, like, I'm guessing that the seven sacred virgins entombed side by side are what he considers, like, the better of his victims?
Yes.
And those less worthy are scattered wide, like, basically the less good or pure victims?
Yeah.
So I don't, or just put anywhere else? Like, what is this what is happening here?
Yeah, I don't want to give too much space because we're giving a lot of space to his words. But basically, he has said in other contexts that basically he feels that like a lot of women are horrible and untrustworthy. And he really categorizes them as like beneath him and doesn't really feel, I don't think, that they should be alive. And so there are, according to him in this riddly poem, seven who have qualified as worthy to him. And those are the seven virgins. And then there are other people, right?
Okay. It's really gross. Like, I know, like you said, you don't want to give much space to his words, but his, like, it's just gross.
Right. And so investigators are, like, stumped. They're asking, like, who is this high priestess? Mm-hmm. What does draining and digging mean? They're really coming up with nothing. So soon after this, Finley gets another letter. This one says, the score is you won, the other team 48. Are you willing to settle for this? You have the information to make the score 8-48, somewhat better, but you seem not to have the insight or ambition to score. In addition, if you were to drive to the end zone in a white Grand Am, the score would be 9-48. That would complete your home court sphere. And he kind of goes on from there, but that's mostly just taunting Finley for not figuring it out.
He's annoying.
Yeah.
It's just like, I don't know how angry this officer would be, like, getting these, like.
Yeah.
What would that feel like when you're trying to solve something and somebody is, like, playing around like this?
Right. And so it's clear they have more information here. It's definitely clear that he's saying there are at least nine murders that happened in Colorado. There's Heather, the seven virgins or missed opportunities that he's mentioned, and then there's something to do with a white Grandam. And what he seems to be saying is that total, he committed 48 murders. To that end, he actually sends a map with numbers on it indicating the totals in those states. It's Louisiana, where he's from, with the number 17 on it, Colorado 9, Texas 7, Arkansas 5, Alabama 3, California, New Mexico, and Oklahoma each with 2, and Washington 1.
Are we going to find out more about these numbers?
No, in some regards, yes.
Okay.
So, and it's hard to say how this was received by investigators at first. We've talked before when we covered the Jane Doe known as Norma that serial killer confessions from within jail are not always believed, largely because it's seen as a way to gain infamy and attention, and maybe even some privileges in jail. And that comes from someone who confessed to hundreds of murders, who really made investigators who believed him look foolish. And so since then, there's been this like pushback against believing any kind of jailhouse confession like this. So despite what seems like a lot of information and more clues, they're really not throwing their resources into figuring out what he's saying. And beyond that, Finley had other cases he needed to work in. He kind of decides that R is just messing with him and just doesn't continue the correspondence.
We'll be back in a moment.
And so things really go on pause for a while. And by a while, I mean 2 years. That's when three men, Charlie Hess, Scott Fisher, and Lou Smith, decide to dive back into the case. Now, all three men were retired from law enforcement and basically volunteered to work cold case files in El Paso County. Smith, if you remember, had been on Heather Church's case back when it was solved. Now, apparently around 2002, the men were looking for a case to work, and they were having a conversation when Charlie Hess asked Lou Smith if he ever encountered someone who he thought might be a serial killer. For Lou, the answer was immediate. He absolutely thought from the beginning, back on Heather's case, that R was a serial killer. Which is why they start digging back in, and they realize that he has communicated as much 2 years prior in his letters to Finley. Now, Charlie Hess, he suggests that they write to R, and they decide together to use Charlie as the main point of contact. They obviously couldn't use Smith, since he would have been recognizable to R based on the previous case.
So they're only figuring out now that he could have been a serial killer?
Yeah, so they're having like this casual conversation, like, do you think you've encountered someone who was? And Lou Smith's like, absolutely.
So even without seeing those letters, he just has this gut feeling?
Yes.
Okay.
So now they write their first letter to R. Meanwhile, R has reached out again to the original guy, Finley. So, like, these letters cross paths. But basically what ends up happening is Charlie and R write back and forth to one another over the course of years. Now, in one of his letters, he had written a clue, which was, December or January 1987 or 1988, White Grand Am, Colorado Springs. He doesn't elaborate on this and really resists giving more information, suggesting that with just this information, they should be able to solve this crime. And it's not like they aren't trying to figure out this White Grand Am situation. It's now been years that this has been mentioned, right? But they are really not successful. They can't find anything that matches this in missing persons or murder cases. And at some point, R is frustrated and thinks they're faking this cluelessness, right? To basically get him to divulge more information. So he gives them more clues. This time it's that they're looking for a missing persons case of a young woman who was married to a man in the army. He said that the woman and her husband's grand am were reported missing at the same time and that the husband had been angered about how this case was handled. He also added that the husband actually found the missing grand am on his own. To this, he adds in a murder he committed in Flatonia, Texas in about 1984 or 1985. He said the murdered woman's husband had been a suspect. So they go back again and they're trying to find this grand am, but there are no hits. They can't figure it out. On the other hand, the Flatonia clue yields an immediate result. Melody Ann Bush. Her body was found in a culvert on March 30th, 1984. She was 22 and had moved to Flatonia recently. And yes, her husband had been questioned in her murder.
So he's not only doing these murders, he's actually like keeping track of these people after?
Yes. There seems to be some awareness of what investigative process is happening.
Okay.
And now you might be wondering, why is R so forthcoming in the first place?
Yeah.
Like, honestly, that's really only known to him. But later on, we do know he was trying to negotiate various things like moving to a different prison and better health care. Honestly, if I give my own opinion, I think he has really like an inflated ego and really loves the idea of people trying to figure him out or these cases out, right? Because like, honestly, he could have just said very plainly information about the White Grand Am.
Right.
Yeah. Now, without the information on the Grand Am, Charlie has made clear to R that he really wouldn't get what he wanted out of El Paso County's DA unless there was a case within the county that they could use. So he's like, you want better health care? You want to move out of this prison to a different one? You're going to have to tell me something in this county.
Right.
So instead, R gave new clues to a new murder, this one near Houston. This one, he said, happened near the time of the murder of Melody Bush, and the woman's body was found off of U.S. Highway 59. This turned out to be Nydia Itzel Bolivar Mendoza. Nydia was 17 and was working as a dancer at Dame's Nightclub and also as a sex worker when she disappeared in 1984. And her dismembered body was found 4 days later off of Interstate 59. So, but still, this is not the White Grand Am, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're combing through old files. They did find mention of White Grand Am in an old missing persons file from the 1980s, but they weren't sure if it was right. And when they reach out to R, he basically says like, hey, if you're finding anything in the file that is different from what I said, it's not the right one. And instead, he comes back with another letter, which the team starts calling the trip letter. In it, he details some of the murders he claims to have committed. And when I say details, it's more like brief notes, like that in Northern California in 1986, the bodies of a man and woman were left on an oceanside beach that had boulders and driftwood on it. And so they're calling all over the place trying to match murders to R, but the clues are vague enough and the record keeping is poor enough that they don't have much luck in matching these things up.
So it's really hard to like tell if he's just making these things up or not when there aren't these like good records of anything.
Yeah.
It seems like it would be easy to find a woman and man reports of that, right?
Right. Yeah. And some of his other ones are of similar, like, okay, like if there's decent records, like that should be able to match up.
Like even the Grand Am thing, right? Like it seems like they should find something about that.
So he has said, you know, like we have some very solid clues. The White Grand Am, husband in the army, Colorado Springs, the year, right?
Yeah, it seems clear enough, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, he's trying to be all cryptic and like hoping that they'll like sleuth it out and figure it out. And basically every time he gives them new clues, they're like, oh, I don't know. And he's like, oh. And gives them more clues, right?
Yeah.
So finally, Charlie Hess is like, that's it. And goes and visits R in prison to find out more about the Grand Am. And R is like, hey, I've given you all you need. And Charlie Hess is like, honestly, it's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
So R says the woman lived in an apartment complex across the street from him. But that's really all he would add. So once again, they're back. They're combing through missing persons reports, this time looking for any missing person reports near his known addresses. And again, they come up empty handed.
This could really be a movie plot. Because then the guy's in jail trying to be like all cryptic and like what he thinks is cool and giving them these clues. But the police have no records.
Yeah.
And like if he did do these things for real, then he's probably like, wait, why are the police not doing their job?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so January 5th, 2005, Charlie Hess is back for another in-person meeting with R. Again, R says that he wanted to change prison facilities and meet with a doctor, which Hess has repeatedly told him he's working on. In exchange, he would give up more information about the woman with the Grand Am, along with these three murders from his hometown in Coushatta, Louisiana. The details about the Grand Am woman were that R lived on Marie Boulevard and worked at a nearby Quick Stop. He places her residence as across the street from his in a first floor apartment she shared with her husband, who was in the army and stationed at Fort Carson. He said that after the murder, he took her diamond ring and gave it to his friend, Jan. He also stole a Sony television from the woman's apartment. And yet again, this does not help them figure out who the woman was. So they're now 5 years into this case trying to figure it out. A month later, though, R does give up information on three unsolved murders in his hometown. There was Wanda Hudson, who was 20 years old when she was murdered in her cabin at the Rivertown apartment complex, which was owned by R's brother. The murder happened in 1980, and the primary suspect had been her boyfriend. Faye Self, who was murdered 2 months before Wanda. She also lived at the Rivertown apartment complex, and as of right now, Faye is still missing. And then there's Catherine Hayes, whose nickname was Fuzzy.
Oh.
Yeah. She was 16 and murdered the same month as Faye, and her skull was actually found a few months later and was quickly identified as Catherine. Later, R adds a bit more about the woman in the white Grand Am. He says that on the day he murdered her, she went into the Quick Stop and he asked her out on a date to go see a movie. At the time, he said the woman's husband and young child were away and traveling to another state. He thought it might have been Florida or Louisiana, but he didn't really remember. He did say that they went to the movie in her vehicle, the white 1987 Grand Am, and then back to his apartment where he strangled her. He then drove her car to her apartment and stole her television. The next day, he went to work like usual, and later that night, he dismembered her in the bathtub, which is what he had done to Nydia Mendoza years before. He said that he later placed her body into plastic bags and dumped them in the dumpster at his own apartment complex. And when Charlie Hess expressed surprise that he would do this, R said basically, yeah, that sometimes the most obvious things are the easiest to get away with, that basically the obvious gets overlooked because it's obvious.
It seems like a lot of stuff got overlooked.
So much got overlooked, yeah.
Yeah.
He said then he drove the car around for a few days and then left it at an apartment complex near the Quick Stop. He says that he was there working at the Quick Stop when the woman's husband came in, and he had just gotten back from his trip, and he used the payphone there to report his wife and car missing. He even showed R a photo of the car. In R's memory, it's a white car with a blue cloth interior. Now, this additional information does help them narrow their search. They had R's employment records, so they knew that this crime had to have happened between January 1st, 1987 and December 31st, 1988. So they look for all the Grand Ams and Trans Ams, just in case, registered in Colorado at that time, and they got a list of 172 vehicles. And then they're literally looking up addresses and names and making hundreds of phone calls to people who had owned these vehicles. One of the cars on the list had a misentered VIN number, and it was sent off for further evaluation. And it came back with a corrected record and an owner by the name of Joseph Anthony Sperry. They were able to cross-reference the names with addresses and found that Sperry had indeed lived in that area. Then they had to track him down since he no longer lived in Colorado. They found a phone number and got a hold of him. In that initial call, they first confirmed if he was an owner of a white Grand Am. He said that he still owned it, though it no longer ran, and it was in fact in his yard. He also confirmed that he had been in the military stationed at Fort Carson and that his address had been at 4419 Pikes Peak Avenue in Colorado Springs. He'd lived there from August to December of 1987. And then they asked the question that they'd been hoping to find an answer to all these years. They asked Joseph Sperry if his wife or girlfriend had gone missing. And that's when he burst into tears and told him about his wife, Rocio Sperry, who he had last spoken to on November 10th, 1987. Now, before I tell you about Rocio, I just want to make clear, Joseph Sperry had reported Rocio missing as soon as he'd gotten back from his trip and realized his wife was missing.
I was about to ask that. I'm like, why didn't he report her? So he did report her.
He did.
Okay.
Now, are you wondering,
why didn't the police know?
Yeah. Well, so there was a missing persons case file for her, but for some reason she was erroneously marked as found back in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And then 5 years later, her file was removed and archived. All the physical evidence from her case was also thrown away.
So why would someone mark her as found?
Yeah, it was like a clerical error for some reason.
Kind of a big one.
Mm-hmm. So it's taken us a while to get to who Rocio was. Mm-hmm. For years, she'd been known to investigators as the White Grand Am Lady, as R had called her. But Rocio was just a child when she was murdered.
Right. So yeah, so she was married to Joseph Sperry?
Yeah.
But at the beginning of the episode, didn't you tell us she was like 15?
Mm-hmm.
How old's Joseph?
Well, Vanessa.
Are you going to tell me?
Yes. God. Rocío Chila de la Palar was born in Cuba on March 29th, 1972, but her family immigrated to America sometime after and settled in Florida. Now, her mother was incredibly abusive and allegedly beat her in front of witnesses at a public beach. After this, Rocío was sent to foster care. In her third foster home, the Sperry home, she met Joe.
No.
Who was 21 to her 13 years old.
Mm.
Now, to be clear, I do have a lot of sympathy for Joe, but right. I cannot condone a 20-year-old man starting a relationship with a 13-year-old abused child.
Well, and they were her foster family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But regardless of how I feel, the two did move in together. And not long after, Rocío became pregnant, and then they got married.
So she's 15. Married to her foster brother.
13 and married.
Or 13 and married to her foster brother. The time she went missing, she's
15.
15, already has had a child.
Mm-hmm.
And is married. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Like, I feel bad for Joe, too, but at the same time, yikes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, she's pregnant, right? So, she's, what, 13/14?
Yeah.
And with a family to support, Joe joined the military and was stationed at Fort Carson in August of 1987. And that's when they got their Pikes Peak Avenue apartment together and the couple moved in with their daughter, Amy. Now, unsurprisingly, things were not going well for the couple. And I say unsurprisingly because as a matter of personal opinion, you've got a traumatized teenager who's suddenly a mom and married at 15, living with a man who definitely should not have married a teenager. And I've said this before in our other episodes, but like, I became a mom at 30, and that was a big enough life transition for me. I can't imagine being half that age and married and having no family, right?
The no family part. Like, if you are going to be a teenage mom, you need all the support you can get.
Yeah. So she's isolated, alone. Anyway, so the plan is, because they're having these difficulties, Joseph's going to take the baby back to Florida. And I don't know if the plan was just to visit or leave her there and fly back and work on their marriage, but he and their daughter left on November 7th. On November 9th, Rocío called Joseph's aunt to talk to her about a GI she had met from Louisiana. Then, early in the morning on November 10th, she speaks to Joseph, and on the phone, she tells him she loves him and that she would always love her baby. And that's the last known communication with Rocío. Joseph was unable to reach her after that, despite the fact they were set to talk again later that day. So he gets home on November 14th, and Rocío and his friend George were to get him from the airport, but neither of them was there. When he called George, George said that Rocío and the Grand Dam were missing. So when Joseph gets to his apartment, it's in disarray.
Is this girl even old enough? She's not even old enough to drive.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So Rocío's clothes are in garbage bags at the apartment. The TV is gone, and Rocío's hair, which is still in a ponytail, was cut off and laying on a dresser.
It's really weird.
Yeah. So he calls the police immediately, and he's advised to report her as a missing person at the station the next day. And so despite this, despite the hair and the details of Rocío's disappearance, it largely felt like her case was not taken seriously. And so Joseph himself combs through the neighborhood looking for her. And 2 weeks later, he finds his car parked at a nearby apartment complex. And we now know that R was the one who left it there. Now, Joseph, he calls the police, tells them he found his car. They come out, but they decline to fingerprint the vehicle.
Why? They actually declined? They didn't just overlook it?
No. They were like, no. And though plenty of people they talked to about Rocío, they said that she frequented the Quick Stop and that witnesses had reported her walking in that direction on November 10th. They never interviewed or investigated anyone at the Quick Stop.
Okay.
So, like, yeah, I can understand why Joseph would be so angry with the progress and course of this investigation.
Well, the whole thing, honestly, is held, like, when it's put together, the information from it so poorly that even the murderer is frustrated that they can't solve his riddles because of their lack of information.
Mm-hmm.
That's telling you something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that there is, like, enough, I think, to say, like, oh, yeah, maybe this wasn't handled.
Mm-hmm. Appropriately.
Appropriately.
Yeah. So, Joseph when he gets the car back, he says that there was like a square imprint on the back seat as though something heavy was resting there. And his theory is that this was his missing television set that has like left an imprint.
Mm-hmm.
And he even like tries to drive back the vehicle without touching too much in case they can get fingerprints from it. But they're like just patently disinterested in this. So later, when Ars questioned about the TV, he said that actually was in his home in 1995 and was still working when he was arrested for the murder of Heather Church.
So this big piece of evidence was in his home?
Yeah.
Okay.
So in 2005, investigators go and talk to Diane. This is the woman Ars was married to when he was arrested. She still had the TV.
Oh, geez.
And she said she was told that Ars had gotten it from a couple who had needed money and were breaking up. Now, if you're wondering, can they actually definitively tie this to Rocio? No, because basically, like, the only way they have evidence of it is that Joseph needs to remember the exact, like, size of the TV that he bought in, like, the 1980s, and he got the size wrong.
But R is saying he has it.
R says it.
Diane still has it.
Yeah.
Joe knows that it was missing.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, but it's like not like the...
But we don't know if it's the exact one, but I mean...
Everyone says it is. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Now, if you'll remember, he also mentioned that he took a ring from Rocio. This is harder to track down. They did find Jan, the woman that R had been dating and who he had claimed he'd given the ring to. And she had indicated that she had given this ring to her daughter on her wedding day. But when investigators showed the photo of the ring to R, he said, like, that's not the right one. And that Rocio's had been... in his words, bigger and gaudier. They went back through Jan's jewelry collection and photographed a potential ring, but both R and Joseph did not recognize this ring. So still, with the confession and corroborating details, R was facing charges for Rocio's murder. Instead, he accepted another plea deal for her murder in exchange for another life term. Amy, Joseph and Rocio's daughter, gave a statement during this. Amy had just been 4 months old when Rocio went missing. She was 15 months old when she went to live in Mississippi with her great aunt Kay, who ended up raising her. Now, there's differing reports on what happened between Joseph and his daughter Amy after Rocio's murder. Joseph says that it set him up on a path to drug addiction, and he just had a hard time coping with what happened. There are some reports that Amy grew up thinking her father was Rocio's murderer, but Amy says those reports were exaggerated and that while there had been statements about that, many of the family just thought Rocio may have gone back to Cuba. Amy says that her aunt always told her that Rocio loved being her mom and that she meant the world to her. Amy says that though her knees were shaking during her statement that she gave, which I believe was during the press conference following his plea, she stated, "May God be with your soul." And Amy says that even though people may believe that R deserved the death penalty, that she didn't support that option. She believes that there are other cases out there, 40 or more, and that those murder victims also may have children who don't know what happened to their mothers.
So Amy is still working on this now? Like, is she actually like...
I don't think she's deeply in the investigative mode, but I think... she sees the possibility that if they'd pursued the death penalty for him, which they very well could have done, that you lose the chance for more information from him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so usually I would actually end our episode there because I think Amy, who never got to know her mom, like that's an important place. But because there are so many unsolved cases, I just want to create space for that.
Mm-hmm.
So, in terms of Rocio's relationship with her daughter, as Joseph said, the last words he heard from her included letting her daughter know she would always love her. So we're going to end this episode a little bit differently, and that's talking about his numbers.
Mm.
I personally don't believe he's exaggerating those. And it doesn't seem he's in contact, as far as I know, in providing more information about them. And there are so many women and men who could be victims. So in Colorado, we know the murders of Rocio and Heather, and he listed 9, which means there could be 7 victims left. In Louisiana, he listed the number 17. We know of Catherine Hayes, Faye Self, who again is still missing, and Wanda Hudson. That leaves 14. In Texas, he gave the number 7. And we know of Nydia Mendoza and Melody Bush. That leaves 5. In Arkansas, he gave the number 5. And from some other information he gave to investigators, they are able to identify a woman named Lisa Lowe, whose body was found in the St. Francis River in 1991. That leaves 4. He said Oklahoma was 2, and investigators believe one of them was Timothy Lee Warren, who was 39 and found shot to death in 1992. That leaves 1. It also leaves 3 in Alabama, 2 in New Mexico, 2 in California, and 1 in Washington. If you want to know more about those cases and some of the clues he gave, I encourage you to read The Devil's Right-Hand Man by Stephen Michaud and Debbie Price, as well as Hello, Charlie by Charlie Haas, the investigator, and Davin Say. Both books were instrumental in creating this podcast, and both cover much more about R, his history, and of course, the many years-long investigation process. So, given the circumstances of her murder, it is unlikely Rocio will ever be found. So I just want to take this episode to remember that there was a teenage girl who never got the chance to see what Wonder's life had in store for her.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Holy Confession, read by Tanya Todd. Tanya is a writer, director, actress, and activist invested in fair representation in the literary and cinematic world she inhabits. When not writing or filmmaking, she works as a DEI instructor, a sensitivity reader, and co-host of Femme On podcast. She serves as co-editor and contributor for the forthcoming essay collection, Comics Lit, Volume 1, which highlights the value of comic books as a form of high art. Her anti-censorship series, Banned Books Conversations, is available on her YouTube channel, and her directorial debut, Morning Sacrifice, is slated to hit the festival circuit this year.
Holy Confession. Rocio Sperry, 15, missing since November 15, 1987, from Colorado Springs, Colorado. The silken-tongued god speaks in lullabies to the child bride, chapel-mouth prayers curling from his lips. Her eyelashes glistening so thick with tears that she can't see how threadbare they are. Speak sacred memories instead. Marigold sunrises over the ocean. Diamonds crowning the fingers she holds to her daughter's face. The perfect velvet soft inside her car. Blue like jewelry boxes. Sometimes I want to light up her electric halo so bright the night sky aches in the neon glow.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.